Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg.
Hello and welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining me for the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the stories behind albums, bands, and songs. Today, we are looking at one of just the top-rated albums of all rock history, and it is Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys. And so this is all based around a book that Jim Fuseli wrote. It's part of the 33 and a Third book series on Pet Sounds. Jim is the former rock and pop critic of the Wall Street Journal, and he's written a number of books. But I'm going to include a link to the to his book in the show notes so you can get it. I really enjoyed it, and I think you will too. And this was an episode that was recommended by someone writing in saying, hey, I'd love for you to do an episode on the Beach Boys. Yes, awesome. Let's do it. So read the book, got in touch with Jim, and he just has such a fascinating story of his personal interaction with the album. And then he's gone on to interview the Beach Boys and hung out with Brian Wilson and just has a really fascinating story. So I hope you enjoy this as much as I do. If you're joining us for the first time, be sure and hit the subscribe button so you don't miss future episodes like this one. And just appreciate you being here. And I hope you enjoy the interview. This is Jim Fuseli. Hey, Jim, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Okay.
I'm so glad you're here to talk about the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds record. This is consistently one of the top records of all time, and I really enjoyed your book. I especially really enjoyed the intro, the introduction to the book. I felt like had the most personality of any 33 and a Third book that I've ever heard, and I felt like so much of the book had a lot of you in it. It seemed like you combined the personal and the narrative story about what was happening with the band, which as a reader made it way more interesting, and I just really enjoyed it. For people listening, can you tell a little bit about why you wanted to write about Pet Sounds?
Well, Pet Sounds, I would suggest, is the most influential album, certainly of my young life. And as I say in the introduction to the book, it really opened my eyes at a time in life where I felt somewhat like the character Brian is singing about Pet Sounds. I felt a little bit disassociated from what was going on around me. I felt out of place. I was looking for an alternative way to live, alternative emotions. And yet, I didn't think anybody else was feeling this way. I certainly, in Hoboken, in that time period, you certainly didn't talk about those kind of things with your family and friends. I had admired the Beach Boys pretty much from the start. I liked the band quite a lot from the start. And I just thought that Brian Wilson was probably the happiest guy in the world, you know, because of the way that he embodied in his music the California spirit, the sunshine, the happiness, the sense of freedom. And when I came across Pet Sounds and I realized that somebody like Brian Wilson could feel the way I was feeling, it really changed my attitude about life and how to evaluate what I expected for myself. The other thing I wanted to do in the book was try to communicate how I felt about it back then, but still do a kind of serious musical assessment of the album. That was the balancing act that was difficult to do. And in order to explain the pull-through of the book, I need to establish that was my intent, that you were going to meet the writer when he was, God, how old was I back then when the album came out? 15, 16. And yet, at some point, you would meet the critic of the later years.
Well, that's super interesting, too, because I was having an interview with someone else recently, and they brought that up when they were trying to objectively go through the music in rank songs was the thing we were specifically talking about. And the thing that was brought up was like, there's so much emotion tied to so many songs, and there's so much personal experience tied to songs and bands. And I think that that's, for me, that's what makes it the most fun. Like being able to put on a song and you're taken back many years or to a special memory or a specific thing. So being able to objectively try to push those feelings away and just look at the music for what it is, that's a hard thing, right? But I like the way that you talked about that. You gave a quote in the book, and you said one writer described Pet Sounds as a sad songs about happiness. What do you think that writer meant by that statement?
No, my take on Pet Sounds is a lot different than casual fans of Pet Sounds, but it's somewhat similar to the opinion of people who know Pet Sounds really well. It's not a happy album. It's an album that I see as documenting the psychological collapse of the primary artist. Repeatedly in Pet Sounds, Brian talks about being out of place, being unhappy with his present situation, wishing things were different, communicating a sense of life outside of his grasp. And this is a tragedy, because if you look at the facts of Brian's life, he should have been very happy. He was married. He had his brothers around him. He had a group of friends. He was acknowledged widely for his talent. He had achieved the things he set out to achieve professionally from a very young age. And yet, none of this made him content. None of this gave him a profound level of satisfaction. I mean, it comes from the opening bars of the first song. You know, wouldn't it be nice if we were older? Then we wouldn't have to wait so long. Well, Brian was already married by that time. You know, he was already established. He owned a home in Beverly Hills. He didn't have to wait for anything if you look at the facts of his life. So from the very beginning, the opening bars of the lyric, when the lyric enters, it's a statement of discontentment.
That's true.
And that pulls through the entire album. Time and time again, Brian tells us directly that he's lost.
Well, I liked how you described the introduction to Wouldn't It Be Nice, because you described it as almost like a childlike, I don't remember the specifics, but it's like a childlike toy, like that little, like the twinkly sounds that open up the record, and it's followed by a snare, whack. And then that was like the issuing in from like innocence to reality, I think is how you described it. And I was like, whoa, that is a really cool description of a song that I knew really well. And it made me think about it in totally a different way.
You know, Hal Blaine's playing throughout the album is very subtle. I mean, there's a couple of tunes where the kettle drums are featured prominently, but by and large, Hal's playing is really understated. And yet, that's his introduction on Pet Sounds sounds like gunfire. I mean, he hits the snare so hard,
yeah,
that it jolts you awake, and
yeah,
it immediately sends you in a different direction. It's a warning, that sound.
I love that, and I had never thought of it like that. I was like, yeah, it totally is that. Well, so you kind of alluded to this at the beginning, but I didn't know the background of this album until the book. But you know, you talk about sunny California and songs and surfing USA, and you, like you said, you would assume that these guys are happy and that Brian is living the high life and is had a carefree life. But really, gosh, when you talk about him growing up and his dad, who sounded abusive and maybe even made him deaf in one ear, can you talk about that? What life growing up must have been like for Brian Wilson?
Yeah, I once asked Mike Love to describe Murray, who was father to Brian, Carl, and Dennis. And Mike Love said, a miserable human being.
Oof.
And I think, in certainly in the parlance of our times, Murray would have been considered an abusive parent, psychologically abusive and physically abusive to his sons. And I think if you see the movie Love and Mercy, about Brian and his psychological decline, I think Murray gets off really lightly in that movie. I don't think that it's conveyed about just how terrible he was. I actually asked Brian about Murray, and he's reticent to say anything profoundly negative. I asked him if his father ever gave him a feeling of approval, and he reluctantly said yes. And at other times, Brian said that without Murray driving him, there wouldn't be a Beach Boys. But there's certainly a better way to motivate people than Murray did.
No kidding.
And, you know, one has a sense that, and, you know, by the way, there you can find recordings on YouTube of Murray haranguing the band and yelling at the band and yelling at Brian and yelling at. And when you listen to these, you get the sense that this is, first of all, just a bully. Mm-hmm. And secondly, somebody who's jealous of the success of his
son.
Yeah.
Their sons. Yeah.
You know, when a parent has that trait, I think he's unsalvageable as certainly as a parent and perhaps as a person.
I hated hearing that part of the story because I did not remember that part. Correct me if I'm wrong on the sequence of events, but I believe that Murray managed the band for a good while, and then he did come in and had another one of those episodes where I think he was drunk and he was yelling at Brian about how to sing a part or that he was not any good or whatever it was. And so that was the point where Brian Wilson fired his dad. And you made the comment that he was obviously lousy as a dad, and he must have been twice as bad a manager. Gosh, I guess the question is like how much of an effect did Murray have on the group? I mean, like you said, he obviously was probably essential, I assume, to getting things going. But I would also imagine it would have been freeing for Brian to be able to say, "You're done. You know, this is my deal now. You're out."
Yeah, I think Murray got them the deal with Capitol, and with Capitol pushed them to be as productive as they were in their early years. You know, all three of the boys grew, and Mike, who was Murray's nephew, you know, grew into the capacity to take care of business themselves. If he was coming to the studio and his presence was a negative factor, there was really no reason to have him around. When we think of the Beatles, for example, you know, the only band I think that you can compare to the Beach Boys during that time period, they went to Germany by themselves. They didn't need somebody to tell them to go to Germany.
Right.
You know, and Brian Epstein helped organize them, but he never interfered in the music. You know, George Martin essentially being the Brian as the producer of the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I can tell, never interfered with their business side.
Yeah.
So there was no need for this sort of cantankerous curmudgeon to be interfering in everything that they were doing. He served his purpose early on, and they were then capable of doing a lot of these things by themselves or accessing professionals who could do it for them.
For them. Well, so let's talk about like when you listen back to Pet Sounds now. I can't imagine the shock that it must have been to put that on for the first time when the band that you know is the Beach Boys is a very different thing in a lot of respects as far as the albums as a whole. You talk about how they recorded. I love how you were very harsh on some things, on your opinion on some albums, like the session where they recorded Barbara Ann was pretty much a live session. And I had never heard about that. And you hear so much fun in the recording of Barbara Ann. But it feels like a very different band than the band that's on Pet Sounds. Can you talk about and you also mentioned that Capitol released a greatest hits record right around the same time as Pet Sounds, and the greatest hits record ranks higher than Pet Sounds, at least in the U.S. Do you think that the public as a whole had a hard time swallowing this new, more mature version of the Beach Boys, or were they immediately all in?
I'm reluctant to criticize record company executives because they come from the business side and it's their job to sell albums. Similarly with Mike Love, when Mike was concerned that Pet Sounds was taking them too far away from what had gotten them fame and reputation, in many ways he was right. You know, mm-hmm. Pet Sounds in its entirety is not easy to digest. It's a difficult album in many ways. So I guess what the people at Capitol thought is, well, we have Sloop John B. We have Wouldn't It Be Nice? So these can be successful singles. But the rest of the album, what are we going to do with this? I mean, it's how are we going to market this album? It's, you know, it comes, it's Baroque pop. It's a precursor to progressive pop. It doesn't have any comparable albums at its time. You know, people who try to say, well, you know, it followed Revolver and it followed, you know, and there's Sgt. Pepper. Those albums are not as sophisticated musically as Pet Sounds is. You have orchestral work in Pet Sounds. You have a huge ensemble of musicians making complex pop music. How do you market this thing? And I think, you know, Capitol just threw up their hands and said, okay, we got to sustain the Beach Boys, so let's throw our greatest hits out there and let's put out this crazy Beach Boys party album, which completely undermines what Brian was trying to achieve.
Totally.
And then, you know, that's business. You know, the one thing about pop back then, and it's hard to look back and remember this, is that these albums were not supposed to have a long shelf life. You know, they were just supposed to be a placekeeper for the next album. And the idea that somebody would be listening to Pet Sounds 50 years later, I bet that didn't occur to anybody in the entire process.
I think you described it, pop records at the time, as being mayonnaise in the sun. They're only good for a brief amount of time back then, right? I mean, and I thought that's so great. I was like, that's so good. So the recording, the whole thing was taken with care and obviously by Brian and the writing and recording and arranging. How do you think the band took these new songs where you've got, at this point, I believe Brian is not touring with the band. So you've got the touring version of the band doing the hits, doing like making the crowds go crazy. And then they come home from tour and here's Brian writing these very intricate, very different songs. I would think Mike Love is thinking, these are not hits. This is not what the people want to hear. I'm on the road. I know what people want to hear. Right. How did that go down?
Well, in the first place, Brian considered making Pet Sounds a solo album. Mm-hmm. And the first single, Caroline No, was released under his name. There are versions of many of the songs on Pet Sounds that you can locate where Brian sings all the parts. But that, you know, that may be just the way that he did his demos as well. You know, in most cases, he had the backing tracks completed before he brought the group in to sing. I think I may have this wrong, but I think Carl is the only one who plays on any of the songs on Pet Sounds. Huh. So, you know, by the time they got there, you know, they may have had a hint that this was going to be something special. You know, it's kind of hard to suss out exactly. I've actually talked to Al, I talked to Mike, of course I talked to Brian. I never did speak to Carl or Dennis. And so in your research, you see that Dennis and Carl loved Brian. And they're not so eager, they were not so eager to say negative things about him. So, you know, the laudatory comments you can take with a grain of salt as being brotherly love. Or you can take them for literally in that they thought he was doing something magnificent. Bruce Johnson has always been effusive in his praise for Pet Sounds. And in fact, it was Bruce who brought the album to Paul McCartney and John Lennon to listen to. But I think that Brian drove them crazy by being overly demanding. And I think being overly demanding, he may have overlooked, you know, some performances that were at least equal to what he eventually got. You know, 30 takes of a phrase is absurd.
That's a lot.
You know, these guys knew how to sing. They knew how to sing harmony. They knew how to sing complex parts. You know, so it depends on your point of view of art, whether the ultimate expression forgives everything or not.
Whether it forgives the carnage of what was in its wake.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about the state of mind that Brian was in? You talk about him having a panic attack on a flight. Like you said, he's married. He's got all this pressure from business, I would think. And he just seemed like someone who was carrying the band on his shoulders with the writing. Like, what was going on with him emotionally when you talk about specifically the panic attack in that time in his life?
Yeah, I think Brian was having living through a nervous breakdown. And that period, I think that his anxiety had blossomed into a full-blown bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. Brian was experimenting with drugs, and my experience in rock over many decades is that there are just some people who should have never tried certain drugs, and Brian and LSD, to me, is a perfect example of that. According to Tony Asher, who is the underrated hero of Pet Sounds, Brian could be intolerable during that period. He would scream, he would carry on, he would disappear, and then he would return all bright and happy, and then wanting to talk about heartfelt matters and start sobbing. And you know, it just sounds like it was just a terrible thing. When I look at Brian, I often think to myself, you know, this guy gave so much at such a high price. I wonder, because I've never had a moment with Brian where I thought he was being completely forthright with me. But I wonder if Brian would say from his heart, it was worth it.
Man.
Or if he would say, man, the first time Murray hit me, I should have hit him back and went and got a job someplace else.
That's heavy stuff. Gosh, yeah, you do wonder. Well, you mentioned Tony Asher, and he was a co-writer on so many of these songs. Did you say, was he a copywriter? Like, what? How did those two get hooked up, and how did they get along so well with their writing styles?
He was an advertising copywriter, and as such, he would be in the recording studio when jingles were being recorded, and he and Brian had a conversation, and Brian was impressed with Tony Asher. I think Brian knew that he needed to get away from Mike Love's type of lyrics. Mm-hmm. And I think Mike Love is underrated as a lyricist in terms of defining the Beach Boys in its first period. But Tony Asher did more than just write lyrics. Yes, he did interpret Brian's emotions and convert them into narratives. But Brian also wrote some lyrics too. You know, over the years, Brian has written some terrific lyrics. But Tony also has said that he also wrote some of the music. And I've actually never heard Brian comment on that. And, you know, Brian didn't bring Tony Asher back for the next album. And I don't know what their relationship is today, but or I actually don't even know if Tony Asher's alive. I'm sorry to say. My thinking, the Pet Sounds that we have today would not exist without Tony Asher.
Well, I love the description of, and you kind of mentioned it a little while ago when we were talking about the Beatles. And about them getting a copy of the record. I think you said that they got a copy of the record and were in a hotel room and just were intently listening to it track by track. How much of a shockwave do you think this sent through Lennon and McCartney as far as like, we better get our stuff together to keep up with this guy?
I'm speculating here based on the reading that I've done over the years. But I would bet that they took it in stride and they just said, okay, this is where it's going now. How can we do what we've done better in line with where the ceiling is now? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, Brian has always been very clear about that hearing Rubber Soul and particularly Revolver changed his approach to what pop could be. Also, I think one of the aspects of the Lennon-McCartney relationship that's also overlooked is that they were very serious about the business of making great commercial songs.
Yeah.
So I think when they listened to Pet Sounds, they did so with some pleasure and joy, and as we all do. And then on the second passage, they took it very seriously about, okay, how does this influence where we can go?
Yeah.
And you know, by the way, Paul and Brian have always had a nice relationship.
Well, it seems that, like, from the outside, that's what it seems like. And I don't remember the exact quote, but I love the quote from Paul McCartney about God Only Knows. And he was like, it was something like, it's very, very good. It was something like very understated, but coming from Paul McCartney, you know that is like a 10. So I thought that was interesting. But for people who weren't there at the time, I mean, was it shocking for the Beach Boys to all of a sudden be seen as a serious artistic band with this album, much like the Beatles turned into a more serious artistic band? Or is that, in hindsight, it's easier to see that?
Well, I think the way we view Pet Sounds today is entirely different than the way it was viewed at the time. Mm-hmm. There were people who resisted the Beach Boys' attempt to become more serious in their expression of what pop music could be. They hinted at some of where they were going with Pet Sounds on the previous album, but Pet Sounds was just such a leap forward. The Beach Boys were judged differently in the UK than they were in the US. They were resented for being overly bright and cheery and surface and writing really about banal pursuits. And then this leap forward would be viewed by some as cynically. But I do think that people who listened to the music heard that something different was going on and something serious was happening. When I look back at those times now, I'm going back to the guy, the character that I write about in the foreword of the book. I can remember listening to California Girls and saying to my friends, do you understand how great this is? Do you hear how sophisticated this is? And they just thought I was ridiculous. They thought, what are you talking about? You know, I'd rather listen to the Stones. And so there was a lot of that going on at the time, that these are just the Beach Boys, you know. But in the UK, they were taken very seriously. They were taken as equal to the Beatles for a brief period. And I think Pet Sounds justifies that.
That's interesting, because I've heard that about different bands. I was talking to someone else who talks about when Coldplay first came out in the U.S., they were a huge deal, and we took them really seriously. And I believe what they said over in the U.K. was like, "Oh, these guys are from here. This is nothing special," you know. And it's interesting, even with Hendrix going over to the U.K. to break big, and then only to come back to the U.S. and get big here after that. It's interesting the way that bands are perceived at home. There's a line in the book that you talked about, and you said you described Brian's writing as hearing someone who can articulate what you're feeling better than you can. And the only thing that I could think of as a complimentary thing that I've experienced is the Psalms within the Bible a lot of time are described as, here are words to help you in, praise God. They're words to help you reach the spiritual element that are written out and articulated. And I was like, that is a very interesting way to say it, is that this is someone who, in Brian Wilson, who is going through things, and he is writing truthful things about himself, emotional things, but people even today who can connect on it, on wherever they're at emotionally, it in such a unique way. That that's one of my favorite things about music, is when you can connect to something where the artist who's saying the thing, it puts it into words, the thing that you were feeling that you couldn't have said in the first place. And I loved how you brought that up. I don't have a question so much as I really love the way that you articulated that.
Well,
I thought that was great.
I think it's interesting that certain songs, lyrics, I'll focus on the lyrics first, resonate with us and may not resonate with someone else. If you look at Pet Sounds, to me, the song of Pet Sounds is "I Wasn't Made for These Times," if you were to summarize Pet Sounds in one song, it would be that one. And I identify with those lyrics almost literally. I know a lot of people who don't feel that way about life at all, who would not think that song speaks to them. I know a lot of people who think of God Only Knows differently than I do. You know, "You Still Believe in Me" resonates with me on a personal level, but I don't think it would resonate with other people on a personal level. And I think that that's one of the joys of Pet Sounds, is that, you know, I once asked Van, I'm diverting here for a second. I once asked Van Morrison about an album that he had released. And I said to him, who did you think was going to like this album?
And what did he say to that?
He said, well, I knew it. I knew it would appeal to the people it appealed to. And I think that
that's good.
Yeah, I think that a lot in Pet Sounds, the reason people love Pet Sounds so much is that it resonates deeply with them. Mm. Now, the other 99% of the world may admire it for its musical sophistication. It's undoubtedly clever. It's never boring. Even those two instrumentals are never boring. Mm. But they may not say that this is the album of all time for me. Mm. And yet, it is the same piece of work.
Yeah.
You know, you see this happen in art galleries all the time. You'll walk into a gallery and there'll be somebody staring at a painting. And it doesn't connect with you, but it's clear that it connects with that person.
Yeah.
I think Pet Sounds is that kind of thing, that lyrically, it really speaks to a specific outlook of life at that time. But if those lyrics are merely clever or merely entertaining, Pet Sounds also offers the sophistication of its music.
That's a good way to put it. You can connect with it on different levels. I think that is excellent. I liked when you talked about the players who would come and play on these sessions. You said like the top guys in town were just dying to come and play on Brian Wilson songs. And I even liked how you described it as when sessions were going long, Brian was the guy who would think of, we need to call in catering. We need to call in food for these guys. And you would mention that Frank Sinatra was the only other guy who would consistently do that. Why did they respect Brian so much? Why did the top players in the recording industry respect him so much? And why did they want to be part of his record?
Well, I think if you look at the players, you know, now they're called the wrecking crew. They were not called the record crew at the time. But if you look at those people, they worked on, you know, probably five sessions a day, you know, and went from one session to the other. And, you know, if they had a Nat King Cole gig or if they had a Sinatra gig, you know, that would be pretty interesting. You know, the music would be, the arrangements would be sophisticated. They'd be interesting to play. But, you know, basically they were bouncing from session to session, playing pretty banal pop. If you look at what Brian was putting down, you get the sense that they were thinking, oh, this could be interesting to play. You know, we have enough, Brian's only handing out chords or describing what he wants to hear. He's not dictating. He's only dictating after the songs begin to take shape. He gave the players a lot of freedom within the confines of his recommendations. So I think they probably liked that a lot. Also, I mean, not to be mercenary about it, but you know, they booked by the hour, those guys.
Yeah. So there you go.
If it took 30 hours to record a 3-minute song, great.
Then you know, so be it.
You know, in a Sonny and Cher session, maybe it took 3 minutes to record a 3-minute song.
That's funny. The whole part where you talk about, you know, the Beatles and the Beach Boys, you know, they ended their careers, but the latter part of their careers and legacies are treated very differently. And I really like the perspective where you talk about the Beatles ended and everything that they did from 1970 on was just to reinforce the mythology that was created in the 60s, but it was a timestamp. This thing is done and we're going to treat it with respect. Whereas the Beach Boys in some ways didn't do that, where you could go, I think you said you could go to like the local state fair in 1978, possibly, and see Mike Love playing, and they were still doing these songs, or they were making the thing that was so good, less good by the things that they continued to do with their career. Can you talk about that a little bit as far as the ending of both of their careers?
Yeah, I think everything the Beatles did was to keep the Beatles alive and to keep the Beatles alive in the way that they were viewed in their time. And I think the four principles plus a small group of people that they kept around them always kept their eye on that. And when John died, Yoko had the same vision. And when George died, Olivia had the same vision. Now Olivia and Danny have the same vision. Mm-hmm. They know what they had was very special, and they want future generations to see it as very special as well. I think that's the exact opposite of what the Beach Boys have done. They have done everything they can to undermine their legacy. Hmm. And particularly, you know, when the band split into different factions, and Brian was incapable of defending the band's legacy, and Mike Love was turning it, you know, making it go backwards in terms of pop performances and the type of music that they were making. I think that if the Beach Boys had had a steward like the Beatles had, or a group of stewards, things would have turned out a lot differently for the Beach Boys. Hmm. As we speak, Brian Wilson posted a video today online of him playing God Only Knows on the piano.
Oh, man. Now, I haven't heard it.
Yeah, Brian posted this himself. It's on his Twitter feed. Mm-hmm. Now, I think a lot of people would say, oh, isn't that sweet? Brian posted this video. I can tell you that it's heartbreaking, because he makes a mistake and stops playing and turns towards the camera with this sheepish look on his face. It is exactly the kind of thing that should have been deleted immediately. Mm. Paul McCartney would never put out anything like that. Never allow anything. Ringo would never let anything like that happen.
That's true.
This is the Beach Boys' approach to their legacy has always been haphazard. Mm. And I think rightfully so, a lot of fans say, I don't get it. I don't get it. I think it wasn't until Brian revived Smile that a new generation, or even several generations since Pet Sounds, but a new generation caught on to what this guy was capable of.
Yeah.
You know, there's been a lot since Pet Sounds to, let's say, Brian's release of Smile, those decades, you could probably cobble together one or two decent Beach Boy albums from all the tracks that they recorded. Mm. And there were several of those tracks that are really superior and very much in line with Brian's and the band's legacy. But by and large, it's rubbish. Mm. And again, I go back to the Beatles group of people who are stewards for their reputation. They would have never let that low quality of music be released under the Beatles name.
Right.
And this, you know, but it happens all the time, you know. In my opinion, Stevie Wonder is tremendously undervalued because he has no such steward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bob Marley, for example, has a steward, has stewards.
Oh, man. Yeah, great stuff.
You know, Bob Dylan has stewards. Bruce Springsteen has stewards.
Yep. People who
manage their careers and always put their best foot forward. Mm.
Gosh, well... That's a really good point. Well, my last question was around what, and I don't know how many times you met Brian, but you conclude the book talking about judging an event of some kind and how you would have to lean over and repeat the question to Brian in his good ear. What was it like meeting him and interacting with him after just knowing him through his records for so long?
Yeah, I think my position as the rock and pop critic of the Wall Street Journal was a little bit that I couldn't be a fan anymore.
Mm.
And that the Journal, I know this sounds terrible. I hope your listeners forgive me, but the Journal was going to outlast most of these people I interviewed.
Mm.
And that the Journal was bigger than most of the people that I interviewed.
Yeah.
So I'm never impressed with celebrity. It never occurred to me. I never interviewed stars. I interviewed musicians.
Huh.
But you know, when I did the thing with Brian, where I hosted, and Elvis Costello was supposed to host an event, and Elvis couldn't do it, and so I was asked to fill in for him, and I just treated it as another thing, you know. There were other people who knew Brian who were on the panel. Van Dyke Parks was on the panel, for example. And it was before a huge room full of people in a huge arena, and it was standing room only. And, you know, we went out there, and people wanted to talk about, you know, Brian wanted to talk about his music, and I was just a facilitator. Mm-hmm. But the energy that was coming from that crowd, I never felt anything like it, you know, and I've been in, in the stands in the seventh game of the World Series. I never felt any energy like this.
Wow.
And when it was over and we went backstage, you know, I looked at Brian and I thought, you know, God, you know, that's Brian Wilson, you know, and I just, that's the guy. Mm. And as I say in the book, you know, Brian came over and said, good job, Jim. Mm. And I couldn't believe it. You know, I couldn't believe it. And the funny thing was, this happened to me a few other times, but afterwards, I had to walk through the crowd to get home, you know, to leave the arena. Mm-hmm. And I could see the way people were looking at me. You know, they're looking at me like, that guy knows Brian Wilson. Hmm. And, you know, after the glow of it passed, I thought, God, what must it be like to be Brian, to have to put up with that all the time?
Yeah.
He's had me to his home. His wife is wonderful. Hmm. But I think I've never gotten anything out of Brian that made me feel particularly, good as a journalist. I just think I got the minimum out of him. I tried lots of ways. I just could never open that door. And, maybe the door doesn't open, you know?
Yeah. Man, well, Jim, I appreciate you taking time to come on the show and share your experience, and especially direct personal experience with Brian himself. That is a fascinating takeaway, and I think that this album still holds up so well, and it has so many amazing songs for people to listen to who haven't heard it before. So if you're hearing about this for the first time, Pet Sounds is such a great record. But Jim, I just thank you so much for your time to coming on to be a guest, and appreciate your wisdom and stories and expertise today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.